Welcome to the Notice and Demand Seminar today. I want to bring up Mr. Bill Thornton. Let's put your hands together, raise the roof, bring him up. He'll be talking first, and we'll have Mark Lucas later on today as well. Come on, bring it up. Bring it up. Bring up that level. Bring it up. Bring it up. Mr. Bill Thornton, take it away.
What about? And I also want to introduce Mark Lucas.
All right.
He gets equal billing. Is that the best we can do for Mark?
Yes.
He's really good.
That's
do it again for him. Come on. Let's do it. Now, I'm going to tell you the truth. I know this is hard for me, but I'm going to tell you the truth here. Mark did most of the work on this. I mean, I collaborated with him, but he's going to get into it. I'm going to stay along my usual lines and talk about the the common law and the courts and this type of thing. But Mark is the one who really is the brains behind this notice and demand. So one of the things in past history is that Mark has looked at a number of things. And he always seemed to run into a wall. There was no completion and there was no protection from the abuse of power. And so then he was about to give up, and he came across 1215.org, and it turned out, I guess I need this up closer here, and it turned out, there we go. Right. It turned out when he came across 1215.org that it reopened the doors to protecting his position. And so that led to the notice and demand and his own experiences and interactions. And he's got 137 cases supporting the notice and demand in the form of footnotes. So this is a real tremendous work that's been put together trying to close off every door that they think they have. And you're going to be surprised at some of the things that he has found in the case law to support what instinctively we knew was right anyway. So he's glaring at me, so I better not say any more. Anyhow, okay, let me get into the essential. We have no picture. It must have turned off. Battery run down?
No, this has a energy saver. And when you get long-winded like that about, you know, me.
I see.
It tries to protect me. Your signal when you...
I see. Thank you. Okay. Well, we have the notice and demand. This is what this is all about. So, how come this is not responding? There we go. Law notes. All right. I'm going to cover some essential things. I guess I'll sit down so I can see the screen here better. I need to make a quick run through this to kind of give you perspective. And the first thing that I want to mention is attitude. It's very important to have a good attitude. If you allow yourself to be angry, or if you allow yourself to be too happy, then your powers of observation drop off. So you have to be sensitive to the world around you. And when you get a strong emotion, that knocks out your ability to see the opportunities that pop up. And I've given frequently as an example, when somebody buys a car, when you buy a car, have you ever noticed that after you bought the car, how many other people were driving the same car you were driving? You know? And that's because your mind gets easily channeled. So you can channel your mind in different directions. And if you are believing that the world is bad, all judges are crooks and that type of thing, then you won't recognize an honest judge when you see one. And believe me, there are lots of them. And many a time I have been surprised by a judge's response. But it's not irrational. What actually happens is that by our methods, not only do we fence in the judge and with law restrict him, at the same time, that same fence protects him from his superiors. And once he realizes that his job is safe, he sits back and relaxes and enjoys the show. Now, there are jerks on the bench also, and I find that about 5% of the judges, you have to fine them for contempt of court before they wake up and realize that maybe you do have real law on your side. But 95% go with the program. This has been my experience. Okay, language and dictionaries, very important to treat. There's a lot of detail in here, and I'm skipping over it because I'm hoping that all of you did your homework, because on the announcement, we suggested that you go to the website and go through it, because that'll mean you'll understand it better, because we're not going to go too deep into the detail. But language is important. You have to realize that the legal language is a separate language, even though it's called English. Just because it's called English doesn't mean it's the same language. Treat it like a foreign language. What I did one time is I sat down with the Constitution and I read and I treated every word as if it were a brand new word I'd never seen before. And at the law library, I used a big encyclopedia called Words and Phrases. And you'd be surprised at how much space is devoted to simple words, like the word to, spelled T-O. I think there's like 2 or 3 or 4 pages devoted just to the court battles over the meaning of the word to. So it's important to understand that legal language is different from everyday language. What we're doing is premised on 3 very important concepts. First is the concept of personal sovereignty. When we rejected the king, we got rid of him, he got rid of us. He canceled all the charters. So we had no king and he had no subjects. And we all became kings. We were the highest law within our own individual domains. And then when we created the United States, we as a people, if you look at the preamble, we the people of the United States ordained and established this Constitution for those guys over there, meaning the United States of America. We're from the United States, 2 words, and they're the United States of America, that's 4 words. And so we created it. We dictated it. Okay? So there is nothing there that says that we gave up anything. So we are sovereign, but we have to assert it. Otherwise, they assume you're a citizen and subject you to their game plan. So sovereignty is one of the pillars. The other thing is the court of record. And in a court of record has to have 4 requirements. Okay. Let's see. Enlarge that. All right. So there's 4 requirements on a court of record. The first item there, the court generally has a seal, but it doesn't have a seal. A seal is not a requirement. But the next 2 through 5 are actual requirements. It has the power to fine or imprison for contempt. It keeps a record of the proceedings. It's proceeding according to the common law. No statutes, okay? There's no statute of limitations. Why? Because in the common law, there's no statutes. Okay? So you can take on old cases if you feel it's worthy of it. And then finally, the tribunal is independent of the magistrate. So the judge is not permitted to make any decisions that's reserved to the tribunal. And who's the tribunal? Well, it's the king or the queen. Okay? And who's the king or queen? It's you. So you're the tribunal. And if you wish, you can delegate the job to a judge, but I wouldn't suggest it. Okay? And then, or the tribunal is a jury, if there's a jury. But of course, you wouldn't want a jury, okay, because you would be the plaintiff, and there's no point in diluting your power. The jury, purpose of a jury really is to protect the defendant from a crazy sovereign. Okay, that's why we have jury nullification. The jury can nullify the law. It can say, well, this law is no good, and not enforce it. So those are the five requirements or five characteristics, four of which are mandatory. And then finally, the third pillar, the third supporting concept, is that you have to be the plaintiff. You have to be doing the suing. Because a court is defined as the person and the suit of the sovereign. So you have to be sovereign, and you have to do the suing. Now, if you're being sued, as in a criminal proceeding, for example, then you have to turn the tables with what's called a counterclaim. And you must, in that counterclaim, you must challenge jurisdiction. Your counterclaim basically says, I don't know what your jurisdiction is, and the burden shifts over to the original plaintiff, who is now your counter-defendant. The burden shifts to him, and he must prove that he has jurisdiction, and he must prove it to your court. And that's how it's supposed to work. So you have sovereignty, you have the court, and then you have a specific kind of court. It's called a court of record, because the court of record has those characteristics. And in California, we have a neat constitutional provision. When you look at the 1879 Constitution of California, and never mind the arguments whether it's been ratified or not, or whether it's real or not, everybody's using it. So you can use it too. And in there, in Article 6, Section 1, it says that all the courts in California are courts of record. But to be a court of record must act like a court of record. Otherwise, it's not a court of record, no matter what its name is. So a court of record is a true superior court. A superior court which is not being run as a court of record is actually an inferior court. And that means that if you happen to be in an inferior court and they screw around with the system, whatever, you can always sue the court itself. When you do a counterclaim, you can actually name the other court as a defendant. Okay? So that's kind of in a broad brush. There's a lot of stuff here, and I could talk for too many hours on the subject. But this is kind of the basis for what we're going to do with the notice and demand. So in the notice and demand, notice and demand actually is your administrative procedure. See, courts don't like people to come in unless they made some attempt to resolve the question before coming in. That attempt is called administrative procedure. And both sides have administrative procedure. You have the state has its more formal-looking, more well-defined administrative procedure, but then you have your administrative procedure too. And when one of the sides fails to honorably pursue administrative procedure toward resolution of the problem, then that's the end. You have now completed administrative procedure. Now you're ready to go to court. When communications get cut off, when you write a letter and they don't answer it properly, they come with non sequiturs, things that have nothing to do with your original query, whatever it may be. If you're in foreclosure, you may be familiar with a qualified written request. That's administrative procedure. Okay? And when you do a notice and demand, that's administrative procedure too. So I'm going to stop at this point. because Mark has some things to say about what he's going to do. And then after he gives you his overview, then it'll shift back to me, and I'll go in much more detail about honor and dishonor and the administrative procedure, what a notice and demand is, in heavy detail. And then after that, Mark will take over again and really dig into the notice and demand that's designed for dealing with the Internal Revenue Service and with the Franchise Tax Board. So are you ready?
Yeah, sure.
Okay.
Well, first of all, a little warning about Bill. Whenever he gives you all the credit, that should tell you that he doesn't want to have anything to do with it.
Can I leave the room now?
No, you got to stay here. You're not allowed to leave. He has been instrumental in putting together the notice and demand. He came up with the critical comments, and quite honestly, I couldn't have done it without him. Enough with the pleasantries. I would like for you to share amongst yourselves this first document. This is the only handout we're going to have today. And why don't we do this? I propose that we start with these documents as this is where I started. So it'll be much easier for me to follow my train of thought. Okay. We'll go real quick through this. We're not going to spend a lot of time on this. But this is how they enter everybody's home, more or less. And what you're looking at is obviously a State of California letter from somebody. This is an actual letter received by somebody. And everybody receives more or less something along these lines. And if you have a pen, I'm going to point out certain things that need to be circled that we will address later as a rebuttal in the notice and demand in details. And we'll go back to this, so hang on to it. We'll do a quick reading, and for purposes of protection, I blacked out the names and data, but we have highlights in there. So I'm going to quickly read, and I hope you can understand the way I'm reading. I'm not going to rush to it. Section 19501 provides the Franchise Tax Board with a statutory authority. Please circle statutory authority. Then it says, please note that a written contract between you and this department is not required for the administration of the personal income tax laws. Those of you have heard of people that say, well, there's no contract and whatever. A quick point here, there's no need for a contract. They are not a contracting agency with you directly. They are triggered only if there is a contract somewhere else with a state of some sort, and they step in. And they are a collection, basically a collection agency, for those of you that don't know that. Then it says, Revenue and Taxation Code, so-and-so. You can research. The question there I have is, why? So that why is that they are presuming that they have authority over you. And the first question that pops in mind, why? If you want to write the little why there next to it, we'll address that question later. Paragraph 2, Section 17 so-and-so provides that the term taxpayer, and this is their letter, and those quote marks were in the letter coming from them. I didn't put those there. Includes any individual, and that individual means a natural person, obviously. The term taxpayer includes any individual subject, and please circle subject. Those are operative words. So taxpayer, subject. To the personal income tax law, including individuals who are potentially liable. Now, that's another circle.
even when no tax is ultimately determined to be due. And that will become critical when we look at U.S. and House Committee means, whatever it is. And then there's a name there that they give a case, the appeal of Fred Dauberger, and circle that, Dauberger. And we have TC memo, that's tax court memo or whatever. And then Internal Revenue Code, section 7701A14. For those of you that don't know, that defines apparently who's the taxpayer. And basically the taxpayer is defined as a person liable for a tax under this title, which is Title 26 of the Internal Revenue. Okay. Then, next paragraph, Revenue Taxation Code defines gross income. I put gross there as separate from income. So if you want, you circle that one. And then I specifically identify IRC Section 61 in the next highlight, as the Internal Revenue Code Section 61 provides the definitions. And then we have a bunch of general definitions below that. And it addresses gross income, means all income from whatever source derived. So when you read this, you receive this letter, I'm sure you feel like, oops, right? Number 16. What am I looking at?
No, 16
for them. Oh, you're talking about 16. I didn't understand what you were talking about. Yeah, yes. Okay. And then it goes into a list of things. Compensation for services. Well, everybody thinks we have compensation for services, right? Let's circle that, compensation for services. And then gross income derived from business. Let's circle that one as well. Move on to page 2. We have a few highlights there. We don't need to circle those because they address income, income, gross income, 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 right? These will make sense when we get to the notice and demand. Arguments implying that a taxpayer did not receive any income from a taxable source have been misconstrued. A reading of Section 61 reveals that taxable income includes all of the items listed there, as well as any other income from any source. That's pretty clear. There are people out there that think that source does make a difference as an argument. Well, here it says the word source is not defined in the statutory scheme. So we say, why bother then? Because there would be nothing that we can come back with as far as the source. And the they choose to use the ordinary meaning of the term, as they say. This, the rule of interpretation is to look to the ordinary meaning of the term. And they give a case. A point of origin of procurement, a beginning, is the source. So we suggest that we don't bother with the source argument. Going down the line, then we have another term, taxable income. Let's circle that one. Thus far we have statutory authority, taxpayer, gross income derived from business, compensation for services. Then we have taxpayer, and then we have taxable income. Now, this will make it a point to address a little more in depth later on as well. But here's the key. That IRC, Internal Revenue Code section, so they go by the same definitions. Taxable income as gross income minus the deductions allowed by this chapter. So one defines the other. We go down later on, which says the next highlight. So as to make Internal Revenue Code section 861, we do not address 861. Because they specifically say that the 861 has no application to the state income tax. So we're not going to talk about the 861 argument today. Mm-hmm. Next paragraph. Compensation received in whatever form. Let's circle that big circle there. Constitutes taxable income. That is their statement. This is their statement, and they make it sound like anything that comes in is income. For, you know, taxable income for the purposes of gross income and everything else, right? Next, go to the next paragraph. Section 18501 provides that every individual realizing a specified amount of gross income, there it goes, gross income again, or adjusted gross income, Revenue and Taxation Code 17041 imposes taxes. Now, there imposes taxes. Okay, are those income taxes or what kind of taxes? General taxes on every individual who is in California for more than a temporary or transitory purpose. Income from sources located in this state, appeal of so-and-so. Every individual subject, and that, let's circle that one. Here comes subject again. This is how they defend themselves from having to explain exactly who's liable. They say, if you're subject, well, then you're liable. Whether a state citizen, sovereign California citizen, self-status, free-born American, non-resident, non-immigrant, non-taxpayer, question mark here, is there such a thing as an immigrant non-taxpayer? Is there such a thing as a non-taxpayer without a non-immigrant? Then there's non-franchised individual. Okay, technicalities. Non-resident alien residing in the state or domiciled inhabitant is required to file a tax return under Revenue and Taxation Code 18501. All right, so we keep that in the back of our mind when we go over the notice and demand. We'll readdress this again. I just want to read through this quickly. Then it says, as a taxpayer, and I want to bring to your attention that nowhere do they say people involved in common rights activities or anything like that. It says taxpayer, 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 taxable income. Everything is related to taxpayers. Next paragraph. California law defines who is required to file a tax return. Attempts to portray oneself as a non-taxpayer, sovereign citizen, or freeborn and natural individual with immunity from taxation, lack legal support, and are ineffective claims against the proper assessment and collection of taxes. The operative word here, we think, is attempts. So basically, if you are a non-taxpayer, you're not attempting to be one. If you are a sovereign citizen, you're not attempting to be one. But the logic behind this is, as what we think the logic is basically if you're not a taxpayer, this doesn't really apply to you. California tax liability, and that's where we find it. If we follow to the next highlight, California tax liability is the operative word. Unless you have a liability from this paragraph, we can, you know, assume that you're not a taxpayer. So it's dependent upon California contacts and California source income. In California, we continue to enforce tax obligations. Okay. Do we have a problem with that? No. If there's a tax obligation, nobody has a problem with that. And notwithstanding self-characterization of no taxpayer. Now, that's no longer a non-taxpayer. It's a no taxpayer. So we have another term there. Okay. Next paragraph, we have highlighted taxpayer, again, taxpayer and Dauberger, which we highlighted previous. So they go back to the same taxpayer and Dauberger. Next paragraph, taxable, taxpayer, income, they are highlighted for you already. But in the middle of this paragraph is something that's of critical importance that we'll address in a notice and demand. It says, the courts have consistently upheld the estimation of federal income tax liabilities by the use of United States Bureau of Labor Statistics and the Consumer Price Index. Well, if you go back to page one, if you look at the top of the page, this letter was sent from State of California Franchise Tax Board, Sacramento, California. Here they are addressing the federal income tax liabilities. What does that mean? What am I supposed to make with that? Or say, I don't know, right? I'm reading that, and all of a sudden they switch to federal income tax liabilities. We'll address this later on the notice and demand. Let's go back to the yellow highlight on the bottom where it says, where the method of calculating what? Income is rationally based, courts have afforded a presumption of correctness to the income determination. Up to this point, we've had gross income, defines gross income, defines, you know, taxable income. But here, whether the method of calculating income, so which is it, income or revenue and taxation code on page one that defines gross income, which are they claiming? It's the operative word. We'll address that in the notice and demand. The next paragraph, penalty of perjury This has to do with the Fifth Amendment, a refusal to file a valid income tax return. Please circle that one, a refusal to file a valid income tax return. What if you refuse to file an invalid income tax return? Okay, and I have one more question. Where do I find the definition of a valid income tax return? Are those logical questions?
Yeah.
Good, thank you. We'll address that, by the way, in the notice and demand. Everything that's highlighted here will be addressed at one point or another. So I didn't know how to make this fun, so bear with me. Under sections 19041, a taxpayer, again, it is proposed deficiency. There's another term. Let's circle that. And I'm only going to read the highlights to expedite this. The subject of the statutorily allowed protest. Okay. Well, that means you have to be under some kind of a statutory jurisdiction to be allowed something. Make sense? There is no statutory authority that allows a taxpayer, there's that name again, to question the validity of the statutory assessment procedure. That kind of sounds like, you know, the slave cannot bitch at the master. As noted by your board in the appeal of Dauberger again, this is the third time, I believe, they mentioned Dauberger. They rely on this case, don't they? Well, we'll address that later. And they say, give taxpayers the right to appeal to your board for respondent action and protest solely for the purpose of determining the correct amount of tax. Okay, well, so what if it's not a tax issue? What if it's a liability issue or a jurisdiction issue? Can you protest that with them since they have limited authority as an administrative agency? Apparently not, and they tell you right there. It's confirmed later. It says, thus, the only contention that appellant may bring to the forum of your board is an argument that the tax amount proposed is incorrect. So we're not going to talk about anything else. That's what they're telling us. Okay. It is well settled that the Franchise Tax Board determinations of tax and penalties are presumptively correct, and the burden rests upon the taxpayer to prove them erroneous. I read that as guilty until proven innocent.
Right?
That doesn't sit well with me. So let's see what we can do about it. In order to carry that burden, a taxpayer, again, must point to an applicable statute. The taxpayer must point to an applicable statute and show by credible evidence that he or she comes within its terms. That is, I don't get that logic. So a taxpayer must point how he's being enslaved. It says clearly, a taxpayer must point at an applicable statute and show by credible evidence that he or she comes within its terms. All right, I have a big question mark there. Let's address that. So put a circle and a big question mark next to it. They tell you right there, you have to point out how you enslave yourself. Unsupported assertions are not sufficient to satisfy the burden. Oh boy. Next paragraph. Income again. The use of cost of living statistics for a particular locale, or average local income again, statistic for a particular profession. All right. Let's circle particular profession. We don't need to recircle income. Maybe we should address the cost of living statistics for a particular locale, but we don't have that in the notice and demand. We didn't need to. I'll address it real quickly. Sometimes if you don't file, if for those of you that don't know, what they do, they use general information about what someone makes in the same category, in the same field, and they use those numbers, and they just slap you with a bill. Anyway. Next paragraph, I highlighted it only for avoidance purposes. Section 861 was addressed previously in page 2 or so, and we don't even need to touch 861. It pertains to different cases. California does not recognize it as a valid claim or anything. Then we jump down to the bottom. It says, certain persons are the citation. that's highlighted, certain persons are promoting the view that U.S. citizens and residents are not subject to tax on wages and other income earned or derived within the United States, so on and so on. The service and treasury are issuing this notice to inform taxpayers that this reporting position has no basis in law. What I gather from this is if you're a taxpayer, a U.S. citizen and resident, they consider you, if you are possibly, we're speculating here, that U.S. citizen and residents are automatic taxpayers. So we'll address that later. Page 5, last page. But it does not matter from what angle a taxpayer approaches the subjects. Interesting. So what do you receive along with whenever they send something like this? There's also another pamphlet that says Taxpayer's Bill of Rights. All right. It's Taxpayer's Bill of Rights. It's not the Bill of Rights. It's Taxpayer's Bill of Rights. And here they say, but it does not matter from what angle a taxpayer approaches the subject. It's pretty clear. Yeah. The State Board of Equalization held in whatever that the due process that's expressed in the Taxpayer Bill of Rights is satisfied with respect to tax matters so long as an opportunity is given. They grant you the opportunity to question the validity of a tax at some stage of the proceedings. That sounds like pay first, you know, and then if you still have any money, we'll talk about it. The California Franchise Tax Board is not an agency as described in Government Code Section 11501B, authorized to provide administrative hearings before an administrative judge pursuant to Government Code Section 11500. We looked up 11501B, and it's some circular, it sends you over to another section and another section. We were not able to make any sense out of it. Would it be legitimate to say, hey, we don't understand what you mean by that? And quote marks, agency, does this paragraph actually say that the California Franchise Tax Board is not an agency, a government agency? Well, what are they attempting to say? Can anyone help on this one? I know there are people far more advanced in this and specialized in this audience right now. If can anyone point out what they mean by this paragraph, we would be very appreciative, because we can't figure out what they mean by this. It's not an agency as described in government code. Does that mean it's not a government agency? Or it means it's a different kind of an agency. Are they under the government code jurisdiction or not? So we would like, you know, inquisitive minds would like to know. And we'll address that later in the notice and demand how we did that. Yes? The gentleman suggests that they're trying to say that, well, the question, I understand that, they're not have to provide administrative hearings, but that's not correct because they do provide administrative hearings.
Before a judge?
Well, that's the thing. Well, what they're saying is because of Section 11500, okay, let's take a quick rest here. 11500 requires the government agency or these proceedings to offer a judicial kind of review in a judicial setting. And they're trying to avoid that by saying, no, we're just going to do a brush over administrative where we take your information. I've been to two of these hearings, and the situation has been the same every time. They take the position, well, the hearing officer, I'm not a hearing officer. I'm not someone that can give you any information today. I'm just here to receive some information. This information will be sent to Sacramento. And they're going to look it over, and if the information you provide shows what they were asking for or shows that you'll have no liability, then we'll decide and we'll let you know later. And that's the hearing that you're trying to get. Yes, sir.
So aren't they just saying that they don't have to do this before an administrative judge?
Basically.
Okay, so that's the meaning of the paragraph?
Well, it could be the meaning of the paragraph, but my question was, could they be saying that the California Franchise Tax Board is not an agency? That's the statement. It's not an agency as described in Government Code Section 11501. So the question is now, well, what kind of agency is it?
Could it be that, I'm sorry,
Yes, sir.
Could it be that they're trying to stay before I'm looking up to go through Google and you stated right now? And then it says this chapter applies to any agency that determined by statute relating to that agency.
Sure.
In other words, stating that if they're not an agency, any rules that would be applied to them to how the proceeding has to be taken, they just don't fall under it.
Sure, that would be an easy way out, right?
In other words, any rules that will apply to a government agency.
Can you summarize what you kind of, I said, spoke briefly, what you're talking about?
Okay, I looked up the government code, the 1501, and it just says, it states, this chapter applies to an adjudicative proceeding of an agency created on or after July 1st, 1997, unless the statutes relating to the proceeding provide otherwise. But Section A says this chapter applies to any agency as determined by statutes relating to that agency. In other words, like the Federal Reserve, they consider themselves an entity within the government, not an agency. So any rules would not apply to them. So maybe the Franchise Tax Board is doing the same thing. We're an entity within the government, making them exempt from following any procedures that a government agency has to take. Bill Thornton states that, the sovereign does not yield their sovereignty to any agencies, government agencies. In other words, they wouldn't have to, it wouldn't be applied to us. You could say, well, we're sovereign. Well, we're not an agency. We don't have to yield any type of procedures, any way you see fit.
Sure. Since we're taking this break, anybody else sees this any differently? Any other opinion?
I think it's just what you stated earlier.
We need the microphone real quick. We need to take a pause on this one and address this issue because it'll be critical.
I believe it's what you stated earlier. They're not part of the government, but somewhat of a subcontract of the government, so they have no obligation to the citizen or to whatever it is that they're sending this letter to. They're basically saying that your quarrel is with the government, not with us.
Good. Anybody else? Any other opinions? Yes, please. Please.
I think also by that statement there, they are giving up their 11th Amendment immunity.
Okay. So we could interpret basically. Any more opinions? Yes. No, microphone. Microphone, please.
I just think that this statement is very broad, and it implies that this is a kangaroo court. It doesn't carry the legal weight, and they're operating under a different jurisdiction. For example, it's not a typical I sue you, you sue me kind of thing.
Right.
It's kind of like a tribunal. They're operating under their own set of rules, and they're not really taking into account, legal, the weight of the law.
Right. Anybody else?
I have one more thing.
Sure.
It's like it's set up just like the parking enforcement agency.
Okay.
Where they don't have a court. You just go before an administrative person who says, okay, thanks for your arguments. You'll be getting the bill. Really, it's like he said, it's a kangaroo court.
Okay. There's one more gentleman there.
If you notice the wording, it says administrative judge. It's not a judicial judge.
Yes.
You're specifying they're not the government, basically.
Sure. They're challenging what kind of agency. That's basically the question. What kind of agency?
They're a business. That's all they are.
Well, okay. Now, the gentleman that started there, I was looking for that word, and that's the operative word. He said maybe. So that is a question, I think, in everybody's mind. Maybe they are. Maybe they are not. Rather than assuming, that's part of our notice and demand, where we specifically ask, please identify what kind of an agency you are, because from this paragraph, I cannot reach, assume, presume any conclusions. Did you want to say something? Yes, Bill wants to say something.
Well, regardless of the words, remember there's substance and there's form. And what they're doing is they're playing form. But if you sue them in a court of record, now you deal with substance. And they are acting in behalf of whoever they pass the money to. when they collect the money, they pass it. So they are agents, whether they want to call themselves that or not. So they're not recognized as an agency, as an integral part of government, but they are an agency in terms of being an agent for the government. So that right of way kind of weakens their position. Also, since they are agents, they're, what are they? Well, it kind of looks to me like they're collection agencies. Okay? So if they're collection agencies, they may be subject to the federal codes for collecting bills. So they've kind of opened themselves. 2 cents worth of.
Everything that was, let's say, speculated by ourselves and you today is reflected in the next paragraph. It says, California Revenue Taxation Code, Section 19044, only provides for an oral hearing if the request is made within the time period allowed for filing a protest pursuant to Revenue Taxation Code so-and-so. This hearing may be an undocketed hearing conducted by a hearing officer authorized by the Franchise Tax Board to conduct such hearings. At the hearings we went, we specifically asked if they're authorized to conduct these hearings. We specifically asked in advance to bring all their evidence that they have for a liability, and we repeatedly got the same thing. Well, I'm not here to answer any of these. I'm not here to discuss these things. I can't. I'm not authorized. A few weeks later, you get a letter from Sacramento, and it says, well, based on the hearing officer's recommendations, this notice is now final, or something to those lines, okay? All right, so when did they lie, then or now? Who lies, Sacramento or the hearing officer? If you wish to have a hearing before a judge, here we go, now they push you into the courts, you may pay the amount due and file a claim for refund with the Franchise Tax Board. If the claim for refund is denied, you may file an action with the Superior Court of California, because we want to be fair. No, it's not there. That's not there. Sorry about that. Your contentions are the same type as those heard and uniformly rejected by the State Board of Equalization. You think, you know, these guys sound like they are bored of hearing so many complaints. If they really were concerned with our well-being, wouldn't they do something about it by now? I mean, are we all crazy? When a taxpayer fails to present credible, competent, relevant, and uncontradicted evidence as to the issues in dispute, please circle uncontradicted. I forgot to highlight that one. As to the issues in dispute, the Franchise Tax Board's determination cannot be successfully rebutted. Just to bring your attention to something, look what they're citing. Dauberger again. And then they have basically their State Board of Equalization decision, their State Board of Equalization, the tax court, the state, and whatever, you know, here and there. All right, so let's take those as authority agencies. In the last paragraph, please note that the failure to timely file required, that's the operative word there, required tax returns, will result in assessment and collection actions, which may include legal actions pursuant to Revenue Taxation Code so-and-so, along with criminal sanctions. That sounds a little threatening. Conviction for tax evasion carries a maximum 3 years prison term and or $20,000 fine. Conviction for failure to file a tax return carries a maximum 1 year jail term and or $5,000 fine. Are we afraid now to pursue this? Anybody would do this or would dare fighting City Hall based on this letter? That's what we're attempting here. And this is where Bill will take over again, and I'll get the notice and demand set up for further discussion. I just wanted to give this emotional speech about their approach to this issue and what they think we are in relationship with them, and then how we think we need to create our administrative record in relationship to them in a few stages. Bill?
Well, thank you.
this was not sent to me. But that was a good question.
Was this letter sent to
you?
Yeah,
for those of you who don't know who I am, I do documentaries. And because of that, I had access to a lot of people in your situation. I'm assuming you're in that situation. And I welcomed to every presentation that we had, I welcomed government people or agents in the audience or in the classroom, whatever, to speak up and help us fight this because, you know, they're part of it. And if they have anything that they want to rebut, this is the time so we don't pursue this in the wrong manner. And that led me to meeting a lot of people, and they opened up and showed me their documents. And then I decided to, you know, I'd never dreamt that I was going to end up speaking in front of an audience. I used to just to be behind a camera, but I'm doing this because duty calls. I have a moral duty, I think, and that's why I'm doing this. What I wanted to say?
I say the letter was to Ed Rivera.
No, that letter was not to Ed Rivera. I did a documentary where Ed Rivera was featured in it, and Lynn Meredith was featured in it. As you well know, these people were attacked, collaterally attacked, not on tax issues, not on the issues. And they were, you know, set up with injunctions, and they were obviously abused by the system. And I don't like that, and I realized we're all exposing ourselves to some degree of danger here. And I propose that we'll associate, I'm hoping we'll associate, and as students, we ourselves become teachers eventually. And with Bill's help, we help to get that started today.
Okay. Looks like it's up and running. Okay. All right. Here it comes. All right. Let's go right to the notice, honor and dishonor. This is a very important concept. Because we have to adjust this. Oh, it finally went away. Okay. Okay, honor and dishonor. This is a very important concept. Normally, when two people have some sort of a problem, assuming that they're civilized, I shouldn't say civilized because that means according to the civil government. But assuming that they're decent people, then they'll discuss it and somebody will make a point and you'll either agree or disagree. And if you disagree, well, then you'll provide some rational, reasonable response and it goes back and forth and you work toward a solution. This is what reasonable people are supposed to do. And that's called honor. That's where you respect the other person's point of view, but then you argue against it in some rational, reasonable way, leaving out the emotions, leaving out the personal insults, and so forth. So when somebody fails to do that, they dishonor you. Okay? Now, basically, every time somebody says something in some sort of discussion like that, whatever you say, that's a presentment. You are presenting whatever information you're presenting to the other person. That person then responds to your presentment, or we might say he in turn makes a presentment back to you. So every transaction consists of a presentment, and then an either honor or dishonor of that presentment. So don't get intimidated by the word presentment. It just means that you offered something to the other person. It could be money, it could be argument in the sense of some rational response, not argument in the emotional sense.
whenever a presentment is made, basically the other person has five different ways to respond. Three of them are in honor, and two of them are in dishonor. Starting with the dishonor first, basically, if somebody makes a presentment and the other person simply does nothing, stays silent, that's a dishonor. Have you ever written a letter to some agency and then they didn't even bother to answer it? That's a dishonor. Now, we're talking administrative procedure here. And it's up to you to decide when you've been sufficiently dishonored. Because when somebody dishonors someone else, that's the end of the administrative procedure. There is no administrative procedure after that, so long as they keep on dishonoring. Now, if somebody dishonors you, you can give them a second chance. You can give them grace, as they say. And you say, well, maybe it got lost in the mail, maybe you didn't understand, whatever it is, and so you give them a second opportunity to honor whatever it was. So silence is a form of dishonor. The other way is argument. And now I'm talking about not rational argument, I'm talking about emotional argument. You know, you write them a letter saying that something is wrong, and then they write back and say, well, you didn't wear a suit at our last meeting. Okay. A non sequitur has nothing to do with the problem at hand. And so when they argue that way, then that's a dishonor. You say, they say that, for example, they might say, you owe taxes. And you say, well, please explain to me your authority to demand a tax from me. And they come back with a letter saying, if you don't pay your tax, you'll have to pay interest and penalties. What does that have to do with your question? Nothing. So they've dishonored you that way. So those are dishonors. Again, it's your decision, but you may decide that that's the end of the administrative procedure. And then the next step, of course, is to take them to court. But there's three ways to honor a request or a presentment. The first way is called accord and satisfaction. This means that, for example, you go to the dentist, and when the dentist completes the work, he hands you the bill. And you look at the bill, and everything is fine. The bill itemizes what he did, has the price as it was understood, and so you pay it. He gives you the bill, and you pay it. So what happened? He presented the bill to you, and you honored it. That's accord and satisfaction. Second way of honoring a presentment is called conditional acceptance. I offer to paint your house. And you say, well, you can paint it provided that you use blue paint. Do you have blue paint? Now, as soon as you make that counter presentment, that is what? A counter offer, right? That's a condition. No blue paint, can't paint the house. Okay? So you can make a counter offer, which is a conditional acceptance. You say, I'll accept your offer provided that we do such and such. I'll buy the house, but instead of $500,000, I'll pay you $450,000. That's a counter offer. That is a conditional acceptance. So you're accepting all the terms except the price. Okay? The third way to honor a presentment is to reject it without dishonor. And what this means is this. You go to the dentist. I happen to like dentists. You get so much pain from them, you know, it's great. You go to the dentist, and he does the work and everything, And instead of charging for a filling, he charges for a cap. Put a cap on your tooth. You look at the bill, and there's no question about it. I mean, he did the work, but he didn't do a cap. He did a filling, okay? So you give it back to him, and basically you say, I'll pay the bill, but there's this what appears to be an error. And so if you would correct the error, then I will pay the bill. So now it's up to him to make a counter or another presentment to you with either a corrected bill or with an explanation as to why the bill he gave you is the correct bill. So you have honored his bill, but you rejected it. Basically, you rejected it without dishonoring it. So whenever you're in negotiations like that, you never flat out shut them out. You always leave the door open for them to come back. And likewise, they should always leave the door open for you to come back. So that leads to a solution. As soon as the door is shut, through argument or silence, in other words, through dishonor, time to go to court. Because that's what court is for. Court is for those who won't honor each other. So here's how the procedure would work in detail. And of course, this assumes that you have enough time to go through this procedure. Everybody can read that in back? Okay. Here we go. This is the procedure. And again, I'm assuming you have time. Sometimes you don't have time, such as in foreclosure procedures and such. But here's the ideal. The first party makes a presentment to the second party. If CD, the second party, honors the presentment, then AB, the first party, acts accordingly. So long as each party honors the other's presentments, the process can move forward to resolution. However, if the second party dishonors the first party a second time, then, I'm sorry, if the second party dishonors the first party, then the first party grants grace and repeats the presentment. In other words, you go a second time. You allow the possibility you had some special problem, maybe forgot, maybe the paper got lost in the system, which can happen. In fact, just recently, I put papers into a court on a case, and four times in a row, the court lost the paperwork. Okay? I noticed they changed their input system now so that it's not so easily lost. But nevertheless, that actually happened. So if I could have gone in there all angry and upset and saying, you guys don't know what you're doing, you've got a screwed up system. I didn't do that. What I did was I went back and I re-presented, and finally they got it right because I didn't see any malice. I didn't see, you know, it was just error in the system. And apparently they corrected it to some degree anyway. But let's say he dishonors you a second time. Then what you do is you make up an affidavit and you lay out the history. You show how you did it the first time, and so now you're presenting it, and you did it a second time, and twice in a row they dishonored your request. Now, I want to make mention of something here. I presume you're all familiar with service of papers. Everybody here familiar with how to serve a paper, a court paper, right? If it's a first paper called an action or a complaint, then you have to serve a summons along with the lawsuit, and you have to have a special proof of service for a summons. There's a special form for that. If it's a second or later paper, such as a motion, or an answer to a motion, or answer to a complaint, whatever it is, then you have to make up You have to serve it, but you have to have a proof of service. And a proof of service is simply a statement by the person who did the service that he did it. So what does service mean? It just means delivering the paperwork. Okay? It's not, no more complicated than that. However, there's a limitation. You're not allowed to serve your own paperwork. Okay? Not court paperwork. You must have a third party, because the presumption is that it's harder to get people to conspire with you to claim that they served something when they really didn't. And you have a vested interest in not serving the papers and having them default. So that's why a third party is always required. Well, I suggest that whenever you serve a presentment, that you meet the same standard that you would meet with court service. Okay? Because that gives you more credibility. There's no requirement that you do that. You can serve the papers yourself. But it gives you credibility when you have a certificate or a statement under penalty of perjury that by a person who's not connected with the case, that the papers were in fact delivered. So each time that we talk about making a presentment, you should have somebody do it for you and then make up an affidavit saying they did it. Okay. So now, after he's dishonored a second time, you make up the affidavit showing the history of what happened, and then what you do is you pass the affidavit along with the other information to a notary. A notary public has the authority to make a presentment, to collect a bill, or whatever. And so the notary does exactly what you did. The notary makes a presentment, and the other person should respond. If the other person honors the presentment, well, then that's fine. You work your way to a solution. If he dishonors it, then the notary would do just like you did, grant grace, make a second attempt. If the notary does not receive a response from the second attempt, then he makes up what's called a certificate, okay? He makes a certified history of the presentments, okay? And at this point, your administrative process is complete. Now, of course, I'm talking about a four-step procedure, which is the ideal, because that leaves out all question about whether or not they're honoring you. Again, you can shorten this procedure, leave steps out if the situation calls for it. Yes, sir.
Who decides if it's a responsive response?
Who decides if it's a responsive response? You do. You respond yourself. Whoever made the presentment is entitled to make a decision as to whether or not it got a reasonable reply. Understand that all of this leads to court process if the person persists in dishonoring. And now the question will come, well, could you convince a jury? You see? So ultimately, the process, the ultimate complete formal process, ends up with a jury making a decision. That's not a guarantee you'll have a jury, but when the person dishonors you and you end up in court, how good is your story? That's why you want the proof of service. That's why you want the four attempts. Okay, yes, sir.
You just stated that we're the ones that decide whether...
The one making the presentment decides whether or not the reply was adequate. But that's not the final decision.
Not the notary.
The notary can decide he didn't get a reasonable response. Okay?
But are you to prepare the paperwork for the notary for her to sign if she agrees with it? Or does she prepare anything for
the you can... Theoretically, the notary will do the notary's work. However, like they do in court, they say, you prepare the work and I'll sign it. Okay? So sure, you can save the notary some work. And also, not all notaries are familiar with the process. So if you put something together and then they can look at it and get an idea of what it's about, then they might go along with it. But the idea is that the person who makes the presentment is the one who decides that whether or not it's an adequate response to his presentment, but it better be a reasonable decision, because if it ends up in court, somebody else is going to be making that decision again. Okay? Yes.
Process, you can also hire a process server to do the service of process.
That's correct. Anybody over the age of 18 can serve papers, but it adds to the credibility if you have the sheriff or a professional process server do the service. Right. So there's it's all a question of levels of credibility. So the more stringent you are according in your service process, then the more credibility you have. The ultimate credibility, I suppose, would be to have a sheriff do personal service where he hands it right to the individual directly. And then he certifies that he handed it to the person directly. After that, I mean, that's really the perfect service. Everything else is substitution of service. Okay, you've probably heard that term. Substitution of service, for example, since you couldn't serve the person directly, what you can do is you can knock on his door and you find somebody who is not him or her, and you hand that somebody who is over the age of 18 and apparently responsible, and you give them the paper, or not you, but the process server gives that person the paper and says, this is legal paperwork for so-and-so. And then you go away and you mail a second copy to the same address. So the two-pronged approach makes up for the fact that you did not serve him personally. So you serve him personally, you just need the one paper given to him. If you can't find him, you substitute a service, less reliable, but made more reliable because you do it twice. Once through a third party in his house and once through the mails. That's what your process server would do. It's what the sheriff would do if you hire the sheriff. Or it's what your wife or husband would do. You know, by the way, your wife or husband can do service, but of course there's always the question of credibility. But legally speaking, if the wife or husband has no interest in the outcome of the case, meaning an actual direct connection to the outcome, then that person could serve papers.
What does the sheriff charge?
I don't know. Anybody know what a sheriff charges for service?
I think it's $50. We'll try it three times.
$50. Try it three times.
And after that, you have to refile.
Yeah. Hire him again. Yeah. The sheriff is not diligent, okay? He'll go make his trip there. If the sheriff hates you and he's friends with the guy you're serving, then he'll probably call the guy up on the phone and say, I'm coming out there at 2 o'clock. Will you be there? I got to serve some papers on you. And the guy says, yeah, I'll be there. And so he goes out there. He makes the call. He goes through the motions, only the guy's not there. So eventually reports back, well, I couldn't find him. Okay, that can happen. In that case, don't use the sheriff. Okay. All right. So once you've gone through that process where you've made your affidavit after two times of being dishonored and the notary makes out his certification. See, the notary is a public official. If you're not a public official, you make affidavits. If you are a public official, you're creating a government record, and so you certify. That's the difference between certification and an affidavit. So the public official, such as a notary, says something and so, and says he certifies it, that's equivalent to an affidavit. Yes.
And California notaries can't certify.
They cannot.
They cannot.
Now, but you can use another notary to sign your act for this notary.
No. There is a way around that, however. First of all, there is one type of paper that a notary can certify that it is a copy of another, and I think it has to do with a living. What?
The custodian of the paperwork.
No, that's not what I'm talking about.
Oh, the power of attorney?
I believe it's a power of attorney relating to real estate. Something in there, you have to look up the rule to see what it is, but they can. There's this one item that a notary can certify a copy of.
Oh, yeah, right.
And that's it, just that one. But although a notary cannot certify that something is a copy of something else, what a notary can do is notarize your statement that you are certifying that it is a true and correct copy.
Right.
So because all a notary is a professional witness or a state certified witness who says that the notary knows who you are and says that is your signature, and that's it. That's basically what a notary is. However, a notary can do a presentment, and a notary can make up a certificate that they made the presentment because they're certifying their own actions.
Right.
No more?
No.
Did they change that?
Yeah, California will not allow a notary to certify any document at all.
No, they can.
Other than, like you say, for the power of attorney. Or it's the document certification by custodian holder, where the custodian of the document certifies that that's a true and exact copy.
That's okay. That's a specific situation, but that's not what I was talking about.
Right, can't do it. No,
what I'm talking about is when the notary is given the job of making a presentment, the notary can now say what the notary did.
I have a notary that certifies mails and does certify presentment.
We can check up on that then.
She's a notary. I've been with her 18 years.
Yeah.
On the definition. You guys aren't seeing eye to eye.
Yeah.
Well,
yeah.
I used to be a notary, and I missed the last cycle. But I did read the new rules, and I didn't see anything about that.
Talking about certified copies. We're talking about a notary saying on this day, this.
There's two different things. There's a certified copy, and then there's a notary saying that I did this. I placed this in the mail.
Right.
I placed a true copy of this in the mail, along with a copy of this notary certificate of mailing.
Well, the notary doesn't say they made a copy. What they say is they made a presentment. That's what's being certified.
Right.
That the notary is saying what the notary did.
Yeah, what
that's
went into the envelope.
Person. Now, I think that's legit.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay, I'll have to check into that rule.
It's in the government.
I'll have that answer a little later today.
I've done it several times in the past few months. They can say these documents were in this envelope and it was sealed and it was mailed to this address.
Well, what I'll do is I'll look up the actual rules and then we'll clear up.
We don't need him to say that.
I'm looking at the notary handbook, and it says certified copies. A notary public may only certified copies of.
We are in agreement on that. Okay.
Yeah, but I mean, but if they're certifying something, like I'll give you an example, like it would be considered like a proof of service, like he stated.
I'll have the answer later today. I guarantee it. I'll have the answer later today on this, exactly what the code says about certifying one's own notarial actions. That's the question before this court, right? And you are the jury, so I'll do a little research a little later on it and see what it says. Okay. And by the way, on the website 1215.org, there's a whole stack of information, notary information. Yeah. There's a notary handbook, I think, from the 1800s. And so, and remember this, that there are things that a notary can do that are not written into the legislation, because a notary is a common law official, okay? And so there are common law things that a notary can do unless the state specifically prohibits it. So you can't say that a notary can't do something just because they didn't have permission. You have to look at the common law traditions of what notaries have done.
It's like you say, they take in the index, they take common law out for researching it. You know, in some of the latter books, or they change it.
Well, yeah, they sometimes what they'll do is they will remove the information. They don't prohibit it, but they remove it, and you think you can't do it. So that's how they control the actions too. Anyway, the bottom line is, I'll have some answers this afternoon. Okay? Yes, sir.
Bill, can I add something to that?
Well, take a chance.
What we do is we use a notary. We go down to the post office. I ask for the postmaster. Uh-huh. The postmaster stamps the document that goes into the mail. Okay? I have a book called Book 100 Form. Okay? And now what happens, it goes through the Postmaster General as being a witness of the verified document through the jurisdiction of the address and zip code laws. Mm-hmm. And it's there as if it had been received. It's there.
Okay.
So now I have a third-party witness that is a postmaster that can be basically called into court as another third-party witness.
And what is he witness to?
That the document was delivered to said zip code and it was done on such date, and then basically when the card is signed by the individual who receives it, okay, it is another witness. So we're using the Postmaster General as that influence of a weapon.
Right, and what he will do is, as a public official, he will then certify whatever it is that he's testifying to. He does not do it under penalty of perjury. See? Government does not declare under penalty of perjury. The government always certifies, which is the equivalent of that. Now, the question is that I'll get the answer to is whether or not a notary can certify the notary's own action of making a presentment. Not making a copy, not certifying a copy, but certifying that a presentment was made. And so at this point, let's consider it unresolved whether or not the notary can certify, and I'll do the research this afternoon. Okay. Anyway, the point is that the notary does make a presentment, and up until today, the notary creates a certificate of dishonor. Okay. So. So that's your administrative process. Now, when you get to court, that concept of honor and dishonor continues on. And the judge is sitting there, and assuming that he's doing his job properly, as long as the two parties are honoring each other, there's nothing for the judge to do. Okay? In fact, sometimes you will see a judge will order people out of the courtroom and into the hallway and tell them to settle it. Okay? As long as they're talking to each other. But as soon as one of them starts dishonoring, now the judge can step in. So when an individual dishonors and the other party is in honor, the judge can now invoke the principle of parens patria, which means that the government is responsible for idiots, imbeciles, and poor people. Okay? And so, if you can't handle your own affairs, in other words, you're dishonoring instead of honoring, then he's entitled to step in. And he's going to make a decision in favor of the person who is in honor. Okay? It's almost automatic. again, there's other influences, like did he get bribed, but, you know, yes, you had a question.
Now,
microphone? So.
Now, when you've gotten to this process so far, have you established jurisdiction with the court? Are you proceeding under common law, or are you still under statutory jurisdiction? Because I understand that the methodology.
When you're not in court at this point. This is administrative procedure. But when you get into court, then whatever court you're in, whether it's statutory or common law or court of record, is 100% up to you as a plaintiff, because you select the forum. My choice is to always select a court of record. That gives me maximum power. But you don't have to do that. You know, you could. What I say is, if you got a method that works, use it. You know, don't get married to any particular method unless it works. So many times I've told people to go hire an attorney. You know, because in my own perspective, it looked to me like that would be better than doing battle my way. But there's other times I tell people to do it my way. You know, so you have to kind of size up things as to just which way you go. But anyhow, the parens patria.
Can a judge exert parens patria in court of record?
If you let him...
You're not behaving right, and I'm going to take over the court of record.
Yeah, if you give him permission, sure.
Okay.
Don't give him permission.
I have a quick question. If you go to court and you're doing court of record, and they're in dishonor, so you're bringing it to court of record, can they argue the validity of your presentment at that point, or is it strictly they're in dishonor, so you have a way of keeping it that the argument rather than going into the details of the presentment?
Well, in any court proceeding, you always have the person who makes the first move, and then the other person always has the full opportunity to make his own story, whether he tells the truth or lies. And then you always have the opportunity to reply to his answer, whether or not you're telling the truth or lying. You know? So everybody gets their story out. It's up to the court to decide who's doing what, saying what, and who's telling the truth and who's not telling the truth, and who's making sense and who's not making sense. That's up to the court.
How do you do the one where he says, I think you need to be evaluated, you're going 30 days and I'm mental?
Well, in theory, he can't do that, in theory. But in actual practice, they do it.
Yeah.
But they recognize the unreliable of that system. The way I know they recognize it is because the rules say that whenever a judge is being evaluated for his competency, commission that's evaluating it can order a specific medical examination to determine whether or not he can do his job. However, the commission is specifically prohibited from ordering any mental evaluations on any judge. Did you get that?
However, the commission can do what?
The commission is specifically prohibited from ordering any psychological evaluations on a judge. They can order a physical examination, but they cannot order a psychological examination. They're prohibited. These are the guys who are trying to evaluate whether or not the judge is doing his job. Okay? So you can see...
Is that the fox and the hen house?
Well, it's that same principle. The fox and you know, two foxes deciding what's for dinner with the chicken, one chicken voting. Yes,
so
sir.
So if he's a sociopath, you're out of luck.
Well, that's right. If he's a sociopath, you're out of luck. That's right. They cannot evaluate on that basis. So, yes, sir. Microphone.
Or a God complex in his case. Can you order one on an attorney? They're on your plane.
Well, are you the court or are you the
It's actually through administrative documents. I actually said that she was trying to tell me I'm a piece of paper, and I said, I think she needs a psychiatric evaluation.
Well, there's theory and there's practice, okay? And remember that remember the number one definition of a court. It's in the website. It's a stage upon which the sovereign puts a show to prove to the rest of the world that his decision is a good one. And this is really an important rule. I put this as the number one rule of everything. And so you don't want to look stupid to the rest of the world, okay? So theoretically, you could be a dictator. You could order anything you want in the court. And, of course, the individual can always demand a jury and have the jury take over your court. But in actual practice, you want to be very reasonable. If you have power, whatever power you exercise, it should always be less than the power that you have. Okay? Power is like money in a bank account. If you don't use it, the interest grows and you grow more powerful with time. As soon as you start using your power, the more you use it, you can use it, but then the second time you want to use it, it'll be weaker than the first time, and people will start losing respect. So don't use your power any more than you really feel is necessary. Okay. Anyway, that's just a practical side of it. Okay, so the parens patria principle takes over when one person dishonors and the other person is in honor in the courtroom. Now, if both of them are dishonoring, the attorney on one side is putting up all sorts of stupid arguments, and the individual pro per, let's say, for example, on the other side is wondering what the whole wide world can be, and he's confused about court procedure, and he doesn't know what's going on. Now both sides are incompetent, in which case the judge now can step in for both parties and decide what's best for you and what's best for the other side. He's got a complete freedom to go any way he wants if you're going to be in dishonor, both of you. If only one of you is in dishonor, then the one who is in honor is the winner. Again, that depends on how things go. You know, if you have a lunatic for a judge, then that's not going to work. All right, so that's basically it. Okay, that's your administrative procedure.
Touch on that quickly.
Oh, yes. Notice and demand elements. I should have. Thank you.
Yes.
Okay. Notice and demand elements. That's under the procedure. So, in the notice and demand, there are basically 8 points to make. The first 6 points are what you would use in a lawsuit. But you had the 7th and 8th points in there as part of your notice and demand as the administrative process leading to court. So the first thing is that you have to say, now, oh, by the way, you can mix these points up. You can write this notice and demand as if you were writing to your dear old dotty grandmother who doesn't know what's going on anymore, make it sweet and nice and friendly. Or you can bring out all your fangs and bite hard on the enemy. It's up to you what style you select, but you must make these individual points if you want to have a really complete notice and demand. So if somebody is stepping on your toe, that person may or may not know he's stepping on your toe. So you have to, by simple rule of courtesy, if nothing else, you got to inform him that he's stepping on your toe. Okay? So you let him know, you're stepping on my toe. Or you sent me a letter that libels me. Okay? Whatever it is, whatever injury that person's causing to you, you let him know he's doing it. And then you explain to him that you're getting injured. Not only is he stepping on your toe, but he's breaking your toe. Okay? And so now I want you to notice that injury and damages are two different words. Injury is the actual harm done. Damages are the money that you get paid in compensation for your injury. An injury can be a loss, and so damages are the replacement of that loss with money. So damages refer to money compensation. So the second point is, as you say, what injuries you're suffering. Okay? The third point is, you tell him he has a duty to not cause you injury. And at that point, you cite the moral rules, the private laws, the public laws, whatever it is that obligates him to not do this to you. You're not allowed to step on my toe because there is a law. Let's say if you want to use the penal code, you could say, well, there's a law against battery. Okay? Or if he's just yelling at you but not touching you, then it would be called assault. But that's causing problems for you, so that's an injury. And so you tell him that he's got a duty to not cause you that injury. So that's your third point. The fourth point is that you point out to him that he's breaching that duty. So you informed him he had the duty in point three, and now you're saying he's violating that duty. He's breaching it. The fifth point is you put a value on the injury. You state the damages, what it is that he owes you. I guess I should have made that bigger, right? Here, is that better?
Yeah.
So, the fifth point is you state the damages. You put a value on whatever that injury is, and there are different ways of evaluating it, and you can go to the moral codes or the public codes, or you could sometimes you can look at the let's say there's a fine for battery. Okay, well, that could be your compensation if you just doing a civil suit. If you want some guidance as to how much to sue for, you can look and see what the fines are if it were a crime. Okay, that's one way of evaluating it. If you're asking for special damages would be the actual the actual damages owed to you. For example, let's say it cost you $50,000 in medical bills. Those would be special damages. Then there's general damages, where you can put a value on let's say pain and suffering. And typically in the medical business, pain and suffering goes two or three times whatever the special damages are. But if it's, you kind of evaluate it, some things are even worse. So let's say that if you ended up as a paraplegic, it probably is worth a lot more than two or three times. It might be 10 times. So there are, you, in the library, by the way, you can get books. There are books that go into the subject of how much damages would be worth for a particular type of injury. But anyhow, you state the damages in point five, what he owes you for the injury, and you cite authority. Then, point number six, you demand that he in good faith do his duty, pay you the damages, and to do so within a reasonable number of time. And typically it's 60 days for government and 30 days for everyone else. Okay. Okay, then those 6 points, those first 6 points, get covered in a typical lawsuit. The seventh point, in your notice and demand, you say, if he does not do as demanded within the allotted time, in other words, if he dishonors you by ignoring you, okay, then by tacit procuration, you will determine for him what the facts are, what his duties are, and the damages he owes you. Tacit procuration. Tacit means that by their act, You can assume something. If two people, let's say two people talk about painting a house, okay? So one day, maybe there was nothing definite, they just talked about painting the house. And then one day, the painter shows up and he starts painting the house. And the owner, he comes outside and he sees him painting the house and doesn't say anything. Well, you can kind of assume from their actions that they had a contract going. Even though they did not specifically agree to it, by their actions, the painter assumed that he was supposed to paint the house, and the owner of the house assumed that he's supposed to paint the house. Since he didn't object, by their actions, they apparently had some sort of agreement. And so later, when the painter gives him the bill, the owner cannot say, hey, wait a minute, I didn't give you permission to paint the house. Well, it was kind of implied because you stood there, watched me paint it. Okay? So that's the tacit part. And then the procuration, tacit procuration, means power of attorney. Assumed power of attorney, tacit procuration. So if he doesn't respond, and you've told him that you will, if he doesn't respond, you will assume that you can represent him. And then you act as an attorney and you determine what the facts are and you determine the damages and what his duties are. So I like it when they don't respond to a notice and demand. Okay? Yes, sir?
I had a question. Let's say you don't... When you notice him with notice and demand, and they just never respond, and you've done it several times, and you just don't want to go to court, would you be able to move forward? And
you want to go to court? You want to go to court without going to court?
Yeah,
ain't gonna happen.
Oh, okay.
Okay. Yeah. Nice try. No, you have to be very clear on these things. If whenever you have something going with somebody, you start off with, let's say, some form of agreement, contract, whatever you want to call it, okay? Now, you have this so-called meeting of the minds. You have some agreement what's going to be. And then one of the two people, either you or the other one, violates the contract. What do? Well, you have three choices. And this applies to any contract. The first choice is to say, oh, well, we'll just go along with the new terms. Okay? He violated the contract. This is our new way of doing business. All right? That's one way. The second way is to say, wait a minute. You're supposed to do it so-and-so. You're violating the contract, and so you enforce the contract. So there's your two basic choices. Either go with it, accept it as a modification to the contract, or enforce it and make him do his part. The third thing you can do is say, well, apparently he doesn't know the contract exists, and guess what? I choose to pretend it doesn't exist. He breached it, I accept the breach. In other words, effectively he's terminated the contract. So, and if you agree to it, it's done. So those are always the three choices in any contract, any agreement. You either can go along with it, you can enforce it, or you can say it's done. Okay? Now, if you were injured because he didn't do his part, then not only can you terminate the contract, you can also now collect damages for the injuries you suffered because he failed to complete the contract. For example, what if he only painted half the house? You're going to have a half-painted house? So you don't want to enforce it. Maybe you don't like the way he painted the house, but it you have to finish a job, so there's your injury. Okay? So you either have to paint over his paint and get it back to what it looked like before, or you have to finish the job, but not with him. So those are your three options with any contract. So finally, that's the seventh point. If he does not do as demanded within the allotted time, then by tacit procuration, you'll determine for him his, the facts, his duties, and the damages he owes you. And then finally, the eighth point is, if he does not perform as demanded, you will take lawful action in personam and in rem, and you could say or in rem, to defend against him and persons acting in concert with him who cause or attempt to cause said injuries to secure your substantive rights and to redeem the damages owed to you. Now, this is a very, very important way of expressing it. There have been people who have written letters to councilmen or to mayors saying, if you don't do such and such, I'm going to sue you. And then they got prosecuted for making a threat. Never, ever threaten to sue anybody. Okay? Either sue them or don't sue them, but don't threaten to sue them. Okay? Now, what you can do, and you have a right to do, and any creature in the universe has a right to do, you have a right to defend yourself. You perceive that he's attacking you, and you can say, if you don't stop attacking me, I will do everything in my lawful power to defend myself against your attacks. That's a fair statement. That's not a threat. That's just saying, leave me alone. You know, respect my rights. So, if he does not perform as demanded, and of course, what did you demand? You demanded compensation for your injuries, right? Now, if he doesn't do that, you have to defend your position. Somebody takes something away from you, you've got to defend that your property rights. You have to defend your personal rights, whatever, but you have to defend. That's the important thing, not sue. You have to go to court to defend, that's fine. Okay? Okay, so then when you make up your lawsuit, you would add your notice and demand as part of your exhibits. And you have all 8 points, everything you put in that paperwork, that becomes part of your exhibit. But then you have to, the first 6 points are meet for the action. The seventh and eighth points become your authorization to sue him. Okay? Your authorization to represent him administratively. And you know, this is basically what the IRS does and the FTB. They send out all these notices, and if you ignore them, this becomes truth. And then you get in trouble. So that's basically the process of honor and dishonor. Okay. Now I'm going to go do my research on the notary question.
Do they want to take a break now?
Would you like to take a break?
Sure.
And then, okay, let's do that. We'll take a
5 minutes
strict. Okay?
Yes, this is a very long document.
Very long document, and we need to use all the time productively that we can.
Sorry, Mark, for being frivolous. I met you a long time ago in Redondo Beach. Yeah. But Nancy...